The CDC says as many as 60 million Americans suffer from allergies each year. And as climate change will potentially lead to both higher pollen concentrations and longer pollen seasons, we discuss seasonal allergies and the pollen count here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. If you're allergic to pollen or have asthma, what happens to your health as the weather warms? Join in on allergies, 800-642-1234. Dr. Gary Steven is an allergist and immunologist who founded the Allergy, Asthma, and Sinus Center in Greenfield. Dr. Steven, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, and good morning.
Good morning to you. We also have Tony Kavanaugh here, Station Director for the National Allergy Bureau's La Crosse Pollen Count Station. Tony, welcome to you.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
Good morning. Well, let's start with you, Tony. What is a pollen count station? How does it work? Give us a tour.
Well, pollen are the male reproductive bodies of plants. They're extremely durable little structures. Pollen travel from flower to flower, plant to plant, by either hitching a ride on insects or surfing the wind currents. Plants that have bright, colorful, fragrant flowers are insect-pollinated. Their pollen is heavy, sticky, and rarely in the air. On the other hand, the pollen we're interested in from trees, weeds, and grasses is small, dry, and buoyant. So it's good for wind dispersal.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, we saw mostly elm, poplar, and juniper pollen. Now that we're past the middle of May, past the middle of April, we'll start seeing more birch pollen in the next week or two. And birch is a strong, significant allergen, and it produces a whole lot of pollen. We'll expect to see birch pollen counts over 100 in the next week or two.
So the role then of the National Allergy Bureau, how do you, you know, what is the role of what you're trying to carry out here?
We are just monitoring and documenting the amount of pollens and type of pollens in the air.
Mm-hmm.
These pollen counts come from an air sampler that stands on the roof of Allergy Associates of La Crosse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This air sampler vacuums air through a small opening, and any particles in that air will stick to grease on a slide that's inside the air sampler. And then after 24 hours of collecting those particles, we'll examine the slide under a microscope, identify the pollen and count them. And it's just a guide to let people know the season has started.
I just want Dr. Steven to jump in here. On the clinical side, what do you see in terms of your patients and pollen?
Those people who are allergic, that it means that their genetic makeup is such that they have made allergic antibodies that react with the different proteins in the different pollens, start to become symptomatic. When you inhale symptoms, it binds with those allergic antibodies, it causes a release of histamine that causes the itching and the sneezing, the watery eyes, the sinus trouble, the asthma. And as the pollen counts go up, your exposure to these allergens go up and the symptoms become worse. And that is why we track the pollen to give people an idea of what is out there. But in general, as the tree season starts in late March to early April, and it extends, it builds over 2-3 weeks, and starts to fade away towards the end of May and into early June.
Mm-hmm.
And when the weather is warm, when it is dry, when it is windy, we're blowing around a lot more pollen and people are going to be a lot more symptomatic outside.
So, Tony, if the National Allergy Bureau is drawing insights on what allergies look like around the country and is trapping pollen, what can you learn from that type of scientific information as you look at these different sites?
Yeah, one study we submitted data for was a ragweed study. It looked at the ragweed season for a 20-year period from 1995 to 2015. And that analysis of data found that the ragweed season in our area had increased in length 15 days over that 20-year period. So a couple more weeks where pollen's in the air bothering people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Pollen levels are measured by pollen grains per cubic meter, ppm. What should we understand from a layperson perspective about these readings? Like, what is considered high or what's considered very high?
Yeah, that pollen per cubic meter of air is a calculated number based on the amount of pollen we see on our count, the amounts of the slide counted and the amount of air sampled.
Mm-hmm.
Trees, weeds, and grasses have different scales, produce different amounts of pollen. So a high amount of tree pollen would be above 90. A high amount of weed pollen would be above 50. And a high amount of grass pollen would be above 20.
Tony Kavanaugh with us, station director for the National Allergy Bureau's La Crosse Pollen Count Station. Dr. Gary Steven here as well, allergist in Greenfield, as we discuss seasonal allergies, pollen. Taking your questions, 800-642-1234. Brad is here from Janesville. Hi, Brad. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I have a question for our allergist. It's a two-part question. Question one, with a drug like Claritin, when is it best to take an antihistamine like Claritin? When is it best to take a decongestant like pseudoephedrine? And when is it best to take a combo like Claritin D? And then the second part of my question is, there's an alternative to Sudafed on the market. I see it often packaged like Sudafed Light. It's called phenylephrine, which is a common ingredient in nasal sprays, but I'm surprised to see it packaged in pill form. Does phenylephrine actually work as an antihistamine in pill form?
Great questions, Brad. Thank you. Dr. Steven.
Yeah, so the antihistamines such as Claritin, Allegra, and Zyrtec are going to work the best at stopping the itching. What antihistamines do is they sit on the histamine receptor throughout the blood vessels and body tissues so that when you encounter these allergens, they react with the allergic antibodies, release histamine, and then the antihistamines prevent them from binding to their receptor that causes all of these symptoms. And so they are best taken prior to exposure. It is always harder to play catch up and wait until you're miserable and then try to beat the symptoms down. But the antihistamines do work fairly quickly. So that is unlike the nasal steroid sprays where it may be a few days before you reach maximum benefit. Taking an antihistamine a couple hours before exposure is usually adequate. So if you're an air conditioning people and you're home on a rainy weekend and the windows are closed, you don't really need it. And then when you're going to be going out on Monday, you can take the antihistamine a couple hours before you go outside. The antihistamines, because they work quickly at the beginning of the allergic response, they don't work as well for congestion. Or at least they don't work as quickly. You do need to be taking them regularly for a longer period of time to get any benefit from the congestion. And the decongestants are good at helping to open up the nose. When there's so much swelling going on, it's difficult to breathe through the nose. The decongestants work well for that. And so you can think of it in general terms, antihistamines for the itching and sneezing, decongestants for the congestion. And they, although the nasal steroid sprays work way better for the congestion. Phenylephrine is a weaker decongestant. Most people find that it does not work as well as pseudoephedrine. It only reached prominence. We never really used it much until they figured out how to make methamphetamine out of decongestants, and it became difficult to get decongestants over the. It became difficult to get pseudoephedrine over the counter, and you can't do that. The meth labs can't do anything with phenylephrine, so that became the dominant over the counter decongestant. It just doesn't work as well. The nasal steroids work way better than either one of them.
Interesting. Allergist Dr. Gary Steven, fielding questions on seasonal allergies, food allergies. Tony Kavanaugh runs the La Crosse Pollen Count Station for the National Allergy Bureau, looking at the scientific side there of pollen counts. 800-642-1234. Room for your questions. We'll pick this up, discuss more in a moment on the Ideas Network. Spring allergies are here. We're learning about what goes into tracking the pollen count, how to handle seasonal allergies that affect millions of people. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to Johns Hopkins Medicine, allergic disease is one of the most common chronic health conditions in the world. And allergies, they can affect anyone, but more often with kids. Call in your questions, 800-642-1234. Dr. Gary Steven stays with us. Along with him, Tony Kavanaugh, the station director for the National Allergy Bureau's La Crosse Pollen Count Station. So, Tony, how often does your station collect samples from the top of the building in La Crosse?
Oh, we collect samples from April to October. That's generally when the pollen's in the air.
So you collect during that time period, and then what is the process like for looking at those samples and then recording that information for the National Bureau?
Yeah, for counting the samples, we add a stain or dye to the sample, and that helps to identify and highlight the pollen on there. Then after counting several millimeters of the sample, we apply a correction factor to it to determine the pollen in a cubic meter of air over the 24-hour period.
Mm-hmm.
And I report that number to the National Allergy Bureau and also post it on our clinic website and send it to the media sometimes.
Mm-hmm,
sometimes
mm-hmm.
It's interesting there too.
Dr. Steven, I'm wondering, what do you watch for out of the National Allergy Bureau?
The National Allergy Bureau is a good source for pollen counts across the country, and it consists of last I heard, I don't know the exact count, somewhere around 140, 150 sites across the country. And for researchers looking at your patterns nationwide, it's very helpful. I'll come back to a little anecdote about that in a second. But for the main thing is for local pollen counts to allow people to get an understanding of what their allergen exposure is going to be for the day or for the season, because there is a great deal of variation depending on growing conditions. When it is when we've got decent moisture, we have pretty solid pollen counts. When we have way too much moisture, the rain is washing the pollen out of the air, or the pollen counts are lower. When it is dry and windy, pollen counts will pick up. But if it gets dry for so long, then the pollen counts kind of tank because the plants aren't healthy and they can't pollinate.
So I see a clear connection to climate there. What is your anecdote?
We have spoken theoretically for decades about pollen moving around on the jet stream, and we've always had people who are highly allergic to tree pollen say that all of a sudden when we get these weird blasts of warm air in February or March. I remember one year we had we had the 70s for a week in February. That was a long time ago. You'll see tree pollen allergic people complaining of symptoms when we have this warm weather, and then once the temperatures drop back down, boom, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've always just theorized that pollen is coming up, but when we get these warm southerly winds that drive the temperatures up at a time of year when it's not supposed to be that warm, it's bringing pollen with it, and people are having symptoms. And then as soon as the weather pattern moves around and the winds come back out of the north where there isn't any pollination going on, there's no pollen in the air coming down, and then it's just gone and the symptoms go away. So this year is the first time I was actually paying attention to the weather reports. I don't watch TV that much. And I heard that we were going to be having record warmth on March, I think it was 4th or 6th, then that first Saturday in March.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran over to the office on Friday, got the pollen sampler ready to go for the season, because I was able to. We didn't have a whole lot of snow. The roof was clear. So I got the sampler up and had it running for that day. And sure enough, we had record temperatures in Milwaukee. The temperature got into the 60s, and we did see pollen on that slide. It was a brief period of time, so we didn't count it, mm-hmm, in terms of mm-hmm. grains per cubic meter. We just wanted to see, is it out there? And the cool thing was, not only did we see several different species of tree pollen, we also had a grain of grass pollen. Oh, and grass does not pollinate until later in the season.
Right.
And for us, the grass pollen starts in mid-May and goes through June.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to the National Allergy Bureau website and looked around the country to see where grass might be growing. And a lot of the pollen counting stations close to us, to us, had not yet started counting for this season, which is typical. You mm-hmm. don't expect that because we don't have much. But there were some. But the closest and some of the closer stations that had already started counting just had tree pollen. The closest stations that were reporting grass pollen that week were in Marietta, Georgia, and Greenville, South Carolina.
So that grass pollen perhaps had traveled quite a ways.
It did. And so this year, yes, I've been talking about that theoretically all the past couple of decades. Now we actually sample and say, yep, yeah, we do have some pollen coming up from the south.
Dr. Gary Stephen, allergist, Tony Kavanaugh, station director for the National Allergy Bureau's La Crosse Pollen Count Station. Let's take a call. Kevin is with us in Madison. Kevin, hi.
Hey, Kate. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick question regarding eating local honey and if that, in fact, helps. I've heard that it helps seasonal allergies from the honey or from the pollen that you get through that local honey, if it's raw. And then also the follow-up would that only address the pollen seasonal allergies from insect moving pollen instead of the wind moved pollen? Thank you. I'll take my call off the air.
Thank you, Kevin. Dr. Stephen, what about that honey?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. You saved me the trouble because after Tony's introduction, I was going to bring that up anyway, because he explained that very well. The different types of plants have different size. The pollen and the larger sticky pollen from your flowers that gets you picked up by bees is not the pollen that you are allergic to. That is why the bees are needed to pollinate, to cross pollinate those flowers, that pollen is not airborne. You do not inhale it. You are not allergic to it. So this is one of the biggest myths in allergy, at least your public facing allergy, is that you can do a form of immunotherapy by eating local honey, and that's just not at all true. You do have pollen proteins in the honey, but it's not the pollen proteins that you're allergic to.
Let's just take a moment here. And Tony Kavanaugh, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. It was a pleasure.
Tony Kavanaugh, Station Director for the National Allergy Bureau's La Crosse Pollen Count Station, giving us an update on the scientific work there. Allergist and immunologist Gary Stevens stays with us, fielding your questions on seasonal allergies, food allergies, allergy diagnosis. We'll pick this up in a moment on the Ideas Network. Allergy season has arrived. Can you feel it yet or not? When do your allergies start acting up and what do you do about them? Thanks for being along with us for a conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Allergist Dr. Gary Steven runs a clinic in Greenfield. He's with us for the hour tackling your questions, giving tips on managing an allergy, figuring out next steps. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in a question from Linda in Eau Claire on air purifiers. Linda, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband has allergies, and I'm assuming that an air purifier in the house would certainly reduce the symptoms, but I'm not sure what kind of things I should be looking for in order to get the most efficient, effective result here. So I'm calling for some advice.
Thank you, Linda. Dr. Steven?
Well, what I used to say is that you want to protect the bedroom. The bedroom is the of the time that you spend in the home. You spend more time in the bedroom than anywhere else. That's blurred a little bit with work from home during the pandemic, but still, for most people, the places that you spend time in the home, you are probably spending more in the bedroom than any other time. Hopefully more like 8 instead of 6, maybe 10 hours a day. And so if you can protect the environment in the bedroom, you are way ahead in terms of your total daily exposure to allergen. One thing is for pollen allergic people is just to keep the bedroom windows closed, and not bring pollen directly into the bedroom. But the best kind of air filter is a HEPA filter. Any filter that says HEPA, H-E-P-A, and one that is sized for the bedroom. They tell you on the packaging how many square feet it will clear. So you get one that's big enough for the bedroom. And the other important thing with HEPA filters is that you replace the filters according to the manufacturer's recommendations. You do a visual inspection. By the time the filter looks dirty to you, it has lost a lot of its efficiency. So if the manufacturer says you replace it in 3 months, then you just do that. You don't look at it and say, it doesn't look too bad. They're expensive. Let's keep it going for another couple of months. Take advantage of its effective filtration, you replace the filter according to recommendations.
I'm staring at right now a couple of air filters, freestanding ones that maybe go up to my knees. And, organizations all over the place have started to try to think about how do we improve the air, improve air circulation? How do we scrub the air in COVID? For organizations that have brought in these air purifiers, what are your tips now, as we go months, maybe years with having these appliances in our spaces?
And that depends on what we're talking about. The HEPA filters, nothing really has changed with that. Some of the new air purification things with the pandemic are UVC that will kill viruses. And also isn't that great for people either. So the, those are, can only be used in unoccupied spaces. They have to be turned off before anybody enters the room. And that is really not anything that's important in a home.
Okay.
That's fine for your commercial areas where there are people you're traipsing in from all over, but in the home, you don't need the UVC. The other thing that you'll see are the charcoal filters, and those are more for VOCs, volatile organic compounds. They're great for organic things, like if you're using paints and stains and things like that. Those are, will not be helpful for viruses. And we're not terribly concerned about airborne viruses in the home, because if you're, if you've got them in the home, you're already infected and you're spreading it around the house. So those aren't that important. So so the HEPA filter is still the best bet in the home.
Speaking of HEPA filters, furnace filters, can changing furnace filters improve the effectiveness of airflow, reduce allergies in any way?
Yes, the I do recommend the thick accordion pleated higher efficiency filters, the MERV 11 or MERV 13, for the home, and those are far more efficient than the standard, you know, 1-inch thick filters that comes with most furnaces, unless you upgrade it. Yeah, so the upgrade is worth it to get one of these thicker accordion pleated filters.
Well, you know, as we're along this air filtration conversation, what about masks? How well do N95 masks keep out pollen, or what do you see there?
They work great for that. Yeah, so, yeah, the problem, the only thing is that the in terms of the pandemic, masks aren't terribly important outdoors when you have a lot of air moving around. But for people that are, you know, sitting in relatively confined but outdoor areas around a lot of people that might want to be wearing an N95 or a KN95, yeah, that'll filter out pollen as well. Yeah. And so a lot of my severely allergic people, they've been feeling a little bit more comfortable, because there are a lot of people that have been masking up when they're mowing the lawn and things like that, and they always felt like they're sticking out like a sore thumb, and it hasn't been as unusual now the last couple of years.
Discussing seasonal allergies, food allergies, with Dr. Gary Steven, allergist with a clinic in Greenfield. Fielding your questions this hour at 800-642-1234. Barbara now in Milwaukee. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. I'm a gardener, and we're told that plants like goldenrod, and just as you spoke of before, those are bee pollinated, the pollen supposedly not carried in the wind, blooms same time as ragweed, and the people with allergies are actually allergic to the ragweed. But I've had so many people with allergies tell me that no, their allergist tells them that they are allergic to goldenrod also. So is that old school thinking? Is that within the realm of possibility? What's up with that?
I have no idea. There actually isn't an extract for goldenrod for skin testing, because people aren't allergic to it. So I have no idea where that's coming from. That probably is something that has been lost in translation along the way. Because you're exactly right. People who ragweed pollinates at the same time that goldenrod does, and people who think that they're allergic to goldenrod are usually reacting to ragweed. That is correct.
Well, Barbara, thank you. Nevertheless, happy gardening to you. Dr. Steven, there's one tip of applying Vaseline, petroleum jelly, around your nostril area to trap pollen. Does that do anything to help?
I would doubt that. I am not aware of any studies that actually looked at symptom improvement. And most of us are not breathing that heavily. only role for that is in a high velocity situation, like in our pollen traps that Tony described earlier, that we pull air into the chamber and it slams into a slide that has some silicone grease on it, and the pollen sticks there. And so if you're breathing so rapidly, you're getting so much velocity that the pollen doesn't follow the air into the nose and then hits on the Vaseline, yeah, it'll stick there. But I doubt that most of us are breathing that heavily through our nose that we would be trapping much on Vaseline underneath it.
Okay, good to know. So can different times a day have different pollen counts? What do you see there about fluctuations in the time of day?
Most plants pollinate early in the morning, so you're right after the sun rises. So the bulk of the tree pollination occurs in the 6 to 8, 10 a.m. Range, which generally is not terribly important because of the winds. Mm-hmm. So that's when the pollen is getting released into the air, but it continues to blow around all day.
We have a question here from Matt in Monroe, called, couldn't stay with us, wants to know whether certain drops or injections, shots, work well to desensitize against allergies. What do you see there?
The shots are the gold standard treatment. Your medications, the antihistamines, the decongestants, and nasal steroids, those help to control the inflammation, beat down the inflammation to tolerate the symptoms better, but it doesn't get at the root of the problem, which is the fact that you are making allergic antibodies, you are reactive to these environmental allergens. And the immunotherapy is the way to change the immune system to make us less allergic so that there's less inflammation in the first place. And that is why the immunotherapy works so much better than the medications, and is such a great option for people who are trying to minimize the use of medications because it abrogates the need for the anti-inflammatory medication. The shots are the gold standard for that. The drops under the tongue are fairly common in other countries, and it is not approved in the United States. And although we have studied it, and we do know that the dose that is necessary for the under the tongue drops is far higher than most people can afford. There are a lot of treatment options with lower dose that some people do find effective, but a truly effective dose is relatively high because most of those pollens get broken down by enzymes in the GI tract. And that is part of the reason why it has never been FDA approved. So there is no insurance coverage for drops under the tongue. There are three forms of sublingual immunotherapy that are approved in the United States. Those are disintegrating tablets that are placed under the tongue, but those there isn't anything yet for tree pollen. There's one on the way, but the ones that are currently available for the tablets under the tongue are for grass, ragweed, and dust mites. So the most effective way of reducing your sensitivity to tree pollens right now is with the allergy shots.
On the allergy shots, on the immunotherapy front, can you give us an example of a shot series, how long it would take, what that entails?
There are two phases, because what we're doing with the shots is we are actually injecting the things that you're allergic to. And so it is not really a medication. It's the same kind of thing that's going into your nose and your mouth. It's just the route of exposure. When we bypass the body's first line of defenses, we don't inhale it into the nose or mouth, we inject it under the skin, the immune system processes it differently, and you tend to shut down the production of allergic antibodies. And since we are injecting the stuff that you're allergic to, we have to start at a very low dose that you tolerate without having a significant reaction to it, because we don't want to be causing symptoms, we want to be inducing tolerance. Mm-hmm. So we start at a very low dose, and then we gradually increase the dose with each injection. You get a little bit more to train your immune system to leave it alone. And so there are two phases of immunotherapy, the buildup phase and then the maintenance phase. The traditional buildup phase takes about a year of weekly injections. There are various accelerated regimens that are available. Some allergists, not as many, use a ultra rapid one-day buildup. One thing that works better for most of us is called cluster immunotherapy. I've been doing that for over a decade now. Which involves two and a half hour accelerated sessions over 2 weeks, twice a week for 2 weeks, and then 12 weekly injections to get up to the maintenance phase. So you get to maintenance in just your 14 weeks or a little under 4 months. And then it is monthly injections to maintain that. The recommendation is for 5 years of therapy, and that comes from discontinuation studies. We find that for people who go through a course of immunotherapy and then stop the shots, if they have put in your 5 years on it, they are much more likely to enjoy long-lasting benefits for years after stopping the shots than if they call it quits earlier than that.
Talking with Dr. Gary Steven on allergy relief, on allergy season, seasonal allergies. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We'll have more conversation with Dr. Steven in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Conversation this hour centers on allergies on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The World Allergy Organization says over 400 million people suffer from hay fever globally, which to a large extent remains underdiagnosed or undertreated. Talking about how to get a handle on allergies with your questions and tips, 800-642-1234. Allergist and immunologist Gary Steven with us for about 7 more minutes. Let's bring in Lisa in Delafield. Lisa, hi.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I have severe allergies to bees. I'm not sure if you covered this already. I've been in the hospital twice. Can you be weaned off of bee allergies?
Great question, Lisa. Severe allergy to bees, been in the hospital twice. Dr. Steven.
Yes, and there is immunotherapy that is highly effective for stinging insect hypersensitivity. But to your point, yeah, there are only two treatments for it, either to carry injectable epinephrine with you at all times to treat the severe reaction if it were to occur, which is kind of a drag, or reduce your sensitivity with the immunotherapy. And immunotherapy for stinging insects has been shown to be highly effective and actually fairly long lasting after you put in a course of 5 years.
So after that 5 years, you've seen positive results there. What about carrying around an injectable pen for those dire emergencies? Why do you say that's an inconvenience?
People just don't like it because it is another thing to do. And they're also just living in fear of getting stung. Unfortunately, though, we never change that recommendation, even for people who go on immunotherapy for stinging insects. We still recommend that they continue to have injectable epinephrine available because the immunotherapy regimen, once you get to do maintenance, you are receiving enough allergen that is equivalent to about 2 stings with every injection. So we know with the high level of confidence, you're not going to have any problems with a sting or two because we're doing that to you every month. But if you were to walk into a nest and get 30 or 40 stings, well, then all bets are off. Mm-hmm. So we never relax the recommendation for carrying injectable epinephrine, but the immunotherapy does go a long way at taking off some of the fear.
What about young kids and allergies and carrying around a pen? When would you suggest that it is injected? What is that situation like?
Anybody with a severe stinging insect allergy who gets stung and goes into anaphylaxis, where they're starting to have wheezing, breaking out in hives is often the first symptom. That does not require epinephrine, but once the symptoms extend on to another system, when you are seeing skin symptoms like hives, and then you are also seeing respiratory symptoms like starting to wheeze, cardiovascular system symptoms, when you start to feel faint, your blood pressure is dropping, that is when you administer the epinephrine.
That's when you intervene. Let's go to Bob in Madison. Bob, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, I just wanted to ask about a method that turned out to be very successful for me. I had like terrible allergies, very itchy eyes, the point where I couldn't sleep, and I tried all of the stuff that traditional Western medicine gives, and I'm like very skeptical of all this Eastern medicine stuff, but I went to like an Ayurvedic doctor, so to speak, and he gave me this like brew of different things, and it was just like, it literally changed my life. I couldn't believe it, and I'm not like, I'm usually very skeptical of that kind of stuff, but I'm just curious if the researchers are looking into more
alternative methods. Yeah. Bob, thank you. Dr. Steven.
Yes, and we have. And for many of them, when we do large studies, large placebo-controlled studies, the effects are not great. That does not mean that there are not people who respond well. And when in medicine, when we make recommendations, we need to make recommendations that we know are going to be effective for a vast majority of people, and that is why a lot of times the emphasis is put on pharmaceuticals that are very extensively studied in terms of efficacy, side effects, and drug interactions. These other supplements and other types of treatments should be part of a shared decision-making discussion with patients when they are seeking treatment. These are valid treatments that work for a large number of people, not necessarily as consistently and reproducibly as some of the other medications, but that does not mean that it isn't worth a try.
Bring it up with your doctor. Dr. Steven, thank you for joining us.
No, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Gary Steven is an allergist, runs the Allergy, Asthma, and Sinus Center in Greenfield. Earlier, we talked with Tony Kavanaugh from the National Allergy Bureau's La Crosse Pollen Count Station. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.